The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A year that went so fast. I wonder if the president feels as though his post-presidency is just around the corner. He probably does. This is The Takeaway's eighth year on the air and the Obama eighth year as president. As we start this new year, we want to try and anticipate the state of the world over the next 12 months. Of course, the ongoing unrest in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and the Middle East. There's the refugee crisis at home and abroad. The gains of ISIS overseas. Europe pulled itself back together in 2015 and is holding, but for how long? The Federal Reserve started to raise interest rates. How will that rattle the markets in the coming year? And then the world is watching the spectacle of the U.S. presidential campaign, surely a distraction, an important distraction, but a distraction nonetheless. To help us think about everything besides the U.S. election in 2016, we turn to Ian Bremmer. He's the founder and president of Eurasia Group, the political risk research and consultancy firm.
You know, our top risk from 2015 was the politics of Europe, that so much of the instability that we were seeing emanating from the Middle East as well as Ukraine would be bleeding over onto the borders. We've seen that play out with the refugees, with the terrorist attacks, with the rise of populism. And I don't see any fix to that in 2016, not at all.
Is this a pendulum swinging kind of thing where the euro is not in favor and there's a need to flex a certain amount of nationalist muscle here and that it will go back once the stark realities of coming apart at the seams become clear, perhaps in 2016? Or is this something that is moving into a different territory altogether?
I'm not worried about this leading to the breakup of the eurozone. Certainly when we look at 2016, the possibility of a British exit referendum going badly is out there. I'm more worried about the fabric of Europe itself. I mean, Europe was this tremendous experiment of international democracy. And when you see the end of the free border transit, the Schengen Agreement, when you see the rise of populism and nationalism in all sorts of elections, not just what we just saw in France, but in Poland and Switzerland, you name it, you know, it makes you think that the Europe we thought we had, the Europe that was about rule of law and democracy, that Europe, it's not a pendulum swinging. That Europe we're losing. That Europe is going down to a lowest common denominator, and it's very much individual countries' governance.
2016, the year that China begins to move the line in the Pacific and move it towards international waters and basically declare the U.S. out of the Pacific?
I don't think so. I think that 2016, the Chinese are absolutely putting more military force in the region. They're building out these artificial islands. They say that they're not militarizing them, but when you look at the satellite photos, they look like bases to me. But the United States will also be expanding its military reach, and neither side wants a fight against each other. The good news in the Pacific, and the good news on U.S.-China in particular, is that both leaders feel suitably secure, as does Japanese Prime Minister Abe, that they're not going after each other. Mm-hmm. They're really focusing on their own long-term needs in the region and more broadly. Chinese economic reform reflects that. Abenomics 2.0 reflects that. I don't think we're going to see that kind of an issue. I think more interestingly is that China's just spending a lot of money.
The Middle East, we talk about the Middle East every year. In the last few weeks, I've seen discussions in the mainstream media that Turkey is basically reaping what it's sown in the Middle East and that the next year is going to be possibly President Erdogan's demise. And then the BBC just did a full hour show saying, has Saudi Arabia caused all of the problems in the Middle East?
You mentioned those two countries that heretofore have been considered, after Israel, two of America's strongest allies. What does that look like? The U.S., of course, the big news from 2015 was a breakthrough Iran deal. They're still saying death to America. It's all on its head. I don't think the Americans are pivoting towards Iran, but they are pivoting away from Saudi Arabia. They are pivoting a bit away from Turkey. Part of it is, my God, this is a mess. The Russians are the lead military player on the ground. We are not going to be supporting Assad. And so that clearly means that there's going to be much more of a fight against each other regionally. Part of it is we don't need the Saudis. You know, it's oil, and they used to be the largest producers in the world, and now we don't care. Things are going badly for both of those countries. Erdogan's made a lot of bad bets in terms of foreign policy in the last couple years. Saudi Arabia has made a lot of bad bets in terms of foreign policy over the last decades.
Mm-hmm.
And those are both coming home very seriously to roost in terms of the civil war and the failed state in Syria, and of course in terms of the rise of ISIS.
Finally, Africa's had a pretty good year if you factor out Boko Haram and the instability in Mali and just the Central African Republic. I mean, the Pope had a very successful visit to Africa. There were a bunch of very boring investment conferences in Africa that involved the entire continent not making headlines, which is good news in Africa. What do you make of it?
I think that the growth of over a billion people, they're much more urbanized than India. Education is improving dramatically. Women are playing a role in these societies. But let's keep in mind, commodity prices have gotten a lot lower. And a lot of the African economies are built on the back of extracting those commodities. That's not changing overnight. It's going to put a lot of pressure on these countries. There's still a lot of corruption. And climate change, great that we have a landmark deal, but it's not going to fix this for sub-Saharan Africa anytime soon. They're the ones that are going to have the extreme weather conditions before anybody else cares. That's going to lead to a lot of forced migration. They don't have the infrastructure to deal with that. So I guess when I look at Africa, I would say certain countries are going to perform incredibly well on the basis of what you've just said, and other countries are going to just fall off the map in a way that emerging markets have seen bigger winners and losers in the last few years. As Africa starts to emerge, they're going to be a more extreme version of that.
Founder and president of Eurasia Group, Ian Bremmer, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
Be sure to tune in on Monday, January 4th, when we will talk with Ian Bremmer about his top risks report for 2016. We'll be very interested in that. How has the conversation about race changed in America over the last 12 months? A spike of intolerance and fear over Syrian refugees reminded us once again that America's vaunted reputation for pluralism is questionable at best. Somehow, it all seems much more out in the open, though. Maybe it's the protests that have rocked nearly every city, both big and small, across America this year. The names Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Khalif Browder, people who died in police custody. There's the Black Lives Matter national protest and blog site. Then there was Ta-Nehisi Coates' National Book Award-winning Between the World and Me, published in the second half of the year, that has shaped so much of the conversation. An unapologetic look at the expectations placed upon black men and boys to be twice as good. What does 2016 hold? Where do we go from here? I'm joined by Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, who says this moment is the result of a hopeful confluence of actions.
I think that Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me certainly put in brilliant prose the relationship of the past to the present. But I also think that it's important to remember the Black Lives Matter movement in terms of really making sure that we had constant and vigilant attention to the issues of premature death and state violence. I also think Bryan Stevens's meteoric rise in relation to his book Just Mercy and
right.
the black women behind the movement, the writers and the anti-death penalty lawyers and people who really speak to the relationship of the past to the present is absolutely critical to the possibility for change. John, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves because we've had moments where we could have changed the narrative in the past.
Can Americans, and I mean white and black Americans, put this idea of freedom and the land on the hill on the shelf while we explore this shared history of injustice and then get to those values, those aspirations in the end? Or do we have to really just shed them and admit that they were a lie?
I think you're talking about a kind of truth and reconciliation possibility.
Right.
That might lead us to a greater sensitivity to what we've been telling ourselves and the limits of that story. This is what a coach describes as the dream. His perspective would be that the dream has to be killed,
right.
And something else has to be put in its place. And I tend to agree, essentially, that there's really, you can't have your cake and eat it too around this. We have to come to some fundamental understanding that the Enlightenment ideals of universal humanity and universal suffrage were flawed from the beginning only in their application, and that as long as we continue to settle for a notion of a more perfect union, we're going to always put our aspirations before our actual lived experiences. So we can do a lot more work in our civic education, what happens in our classrooms. We can do a lot more work in our political discourse about how we win elections. And I'm incredibly frightened by the fact that in precisely a moment for possibility led by activists and incredible writers and scholars, we have a retrograde racist movement on the right led by Donald Trump that is pushing back as hard as it can against the very possibility that you've just described.
Does the rhetoric of the GOP campaign right now need to burn to ashes before we find something new? Or is it sufficient for it to lose at the ballot box and we get a kind of centrist Democrat running things once again in Washington?
I think that there's a both and. We need Trump's rhetoric to be absolutely repudiated in every possible way if we actually want to express values that are humane and compassionate and reflect the multiple contributions of people from all over the world that have made America what it is as an innovative nation. Whether it dies at the ballot box or not fundamentally suggests that there are at least two Americas right now. There are probably three or four. And unless we come to terms with that, unless we find a way to penetrate into the classrooms of this nation, I don't mean with liberal and doctrinaire ideology. I mean just, you know, let's just start with what professional historians publish. Let's just start with that rather than substituting with our state legislative officials in Texas and other places who have gone out of their way with no qualifications whatsoever except their own political ambitions and drive to say this is bad history or this is divisive history.
It's politically correct.
That's the everyday stuff, John. That's the building blocks. And we can't turn our backs on that. If we can't make our kids uncomfortable with the history of this nation, but we can tell them something about the Holocaust at the earliest possible date, then we're lying to ourselves and future generations.
Is it the both and construction somehow that reaches out to those people who are afraid, who have guns, who are angry? What's going to make them less angry, less fearful, and more inclined to engage in this discussion? Because it's getting to them that matters most.
Sure. I think a fundamental reordering of our economic priorities. And that is that we've seen populist uprisings in this country at the turn of the last century. As we moved into the 20th century, we saw tremendous outrage, oftentimes tied to race baiting and racist violence. Not for nothing, the very lynching era that Bryan Stevenson is traveling around the country fundraising for putting markers and monuments to mark every place that had happened was also a moment for tremendous economic inequality for white America. So I think that we have to reconcile that the temperature on our racial discourse is also tied to the complexities and the challenges of our economic inequality. So we've got to do better for white America just as we have to do better for black America, where we don't have 300-to-1 ratios for our CEOs compared to the average line workers. They're looking for something to explain this. And the Tea Party itself is turned to the government as a reflection of that. And the government becomes a proxy for liberal agendas to put black people in charge where they don't belong. Hence, Abigail Fisher in the United States Supreme Court case right now. All of these things are interconnected. And that's why people like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Bryan Stevenson, Black Lives Matter protesters, keep pointing out to us that if we figure out what we've been doing to black people, then we'll figure out how to make this country a better place.
Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, thank you so much and have a great year.
Thank you very much, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
More than 11 million people in America fall into the much maligned category of undocumented immigrant. More than half are from Mexico. All of them are waiting for some kind of clarity about a path to citizenship, a way of applying to join the society they risk their lives in many cases to be a part of. Over the last 12 months, the discussion of immigration reform has gone from weighing the prospects for breaking a political stalemate on Capitol Hill to a strident, fear-driven conversation about security and terrorism. Listen.
We can do a wall. We're going to have a big, fat, beautiful door right in the middle of the wall. We're going to have people come in, but they're coming in legally. And Mexico's going to pay for the wall.
We will build a wall that works.
Mr. President, if you don't secure the border, Texas will.
Comprehensive immigration reform.
The alleged murderer is an undocumented immigrant.
To bring them here under these circumstances is a suspension of intellect.
Believe me. They're not coming from Syria. They're not coming in from Syria. Not if I'm here, because we're sending them back.
Gabby Pacheco is an immigration rights advocate based in Washington, D.C. She has witnessed the evolution of this conversation, watching prospects for real reform go from bad, she says, to much worse.
You know, we have these peaks and lows. And unfortunately, you know, we've seen this time and again, right? When we had our own terrorist attack in 9/11 in New York, people just were really fearful, and, you know, they put all their eggs in the government's basket because the government was going to protect them. And during that time, that's when we passed the Patriot Act. That's when we passed a lot of the legislations that today we're like, oh, we don't really like this, right? All the security and the intrusion that the government has in our lives. But every time that you see horrific acts against humankind, like the Paris attack and San Bernardino, people automatically go into this mindset of, I need to be protected. And so a wall becomes not so much of a bad idea and a costly one, you know, that is costing a lot of money, and that it just doesn't really do much, right? We've seen walls all throughout history come up and come down. And so right now, it's an idea that a lot of people are going on the bandwagon of Donald Trump, saying that he's going to build this wall. But in reality, right, it's just a means of protection. And the community is vulnerable. And these politicians are using fearmonger to, you know, hit the cord of the community.
What's really frustrating to me, though, Gabby, is if you look at San Bernardino and you look at Paris, in those cases, all of the people were homegrown. They were French citizens or Belgian citizens. These were American citizens in the case of San Bernardino, people with valid documentation who don't fall into any of these categories. Yet the assumption is they're the other. They're from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I just don't know why there is such a lack of precision in this debate.
Yeah. And, you know, we could look at all these different acts that have happened of terror, right, that haven't been of the other. And I think it has a lot to do where people come from, religion. You know, we're still in the United States of America, a religious Christian, you know, majority community. The president usually talks about this, right? And he says the us versus the them. And in the United States, there is the us versus the them. If you look a certain way, you're not really considered part of this country. And so constantly immigrants, right? You usually say the number one thing that I hear from people who are not for immigration are, you know, they don't want to speak our language. They want to fly their own flags. And it's this whole idea, right, that because you come from somewhere different, because your language and the way you speak might be a little broken, it means that you are not part of the United States.
People describe the situation right now as unsustainable. Where do you see it breaking down to the point where something's going to have to be done, where it's going to be completely obvious that the status quo is not going to hold? Where do you see that happening?
Well, I personally saw it when Donald Trump decided that he was going to run for president. And really, I've never heard anybody speak the way Donald Trump has talked about the Latino community and specifically the Mexican community. So that was my breaking point. And I don't know really where people are going to wake up and realize that we have a serious problem in our country where we're being divided, where fear is guiding the policies and the politics, and where, you know, it's people might be looking at the national debate, but I'm already looking at the state debates and what's happening in the communities, what is happening in the state legislatures. And I'm going to be following that really closely because, you know, while, you know, we have the presidential election, and that's going to be really important for people to go out and really voice themselves, we're going to see a lot of stuff happening within the communities and our municipalities that we live in.
Gabby, before we go, can you give me a sense, because you have a lot of experience with a lot of actual real people for whom this is, you know, a real issue. It's not just some, you know, op-ed piece. Is there a family that you can think of right now who is living these issues and, you know, from morning till night is wondering if anything will ever change? While they're watching their kids grow up?
So you're talking about my family. So I see this every day, and I worry about, and I have to think about this because in my family, so it's six of us immediately, right? So my parents, I constantly think about them, and they think about, you know, if I was to be deported, what do I do? Because my mom misses her mother. Her mother just turned 90 and she hasn't seen her. She's afraid she's going to die. But her whole entire life is here. Her grandchildren are here and her children are here. And then you have my oldest sister who is in the process of becoming a citizen and will most likely be voting in 2016. And then you have me, that I have DACA and I have this deferral of deportation. So I know that for a time being, right, for a special 2-year time, I know that I cannot be deported as long as, you know, I stay out of trouble. But, you know, it's this life of uncertainty and a life that you constantly want to belong, that you constantly want to be told you are a U.S. citizen, as you feel in your heart you are. But you're constantly being told by the what you hear on TV, what you hear in the media, that you're not. And so, you know, it's kind of when we talk about why we fight and what we do that we do and the activists, right, why we do this, it's because we're fighting for our lives, we're fighting for our families, and we're fighting to be allowed to stay within our communities.
Speaking to us from Washington, D.C., Gabby Pacheco is an immigrant rights activist. Thanks so much, Gabby.
Thank you, John.
Gabby Pacheco is an immigration rights activist from Washington, D.C. Artist Maya Lin achieved international fame at the tender age of 21 when she designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. The remarkable memorial put her on the map as one of the greatest makers of large-scale public art in her generation. Nearly 40 years later, Lin is working on what she intends to be her final series of memorials. They're called What is Missing? It's a global-scale collaboration between artists and scientists that ask that question about the environment. What is missing? It looks at the environmental havoc humans have caused and offers solutions for a more promising future. Lin explains that she's always felt a special connection to the earth and that it's only natural that that connection should come through in her work.
My voice has been deeply committed to caring about the environment. And I started off thinking I was going to become a scientist, a field zoologist. Mm. So the irony is, in all my work, my commitment to green materials and sustainable design and the architecture, my focus in my art on getting you to be aware of our natural surroundings, and then, of course, confluence and what is missing, the fourth and fifth of the memory works, which are very, very focused on environmental degradation at the hands of man and then what we can do to help. In fact, on the website right now under info, there's a section called Green Print, envisioning plausible future scenarios. Emphasis on the word plausible. We have the technology right now in renewables, in recycling, in combustion engine cars to be saving so much energy. But it's also, what can an artist do to think outside of the box? And so we'll juxtapose if it would take $700 billion annually to combat climate change, which sounds like a lot, but then, oh, by the way, that's less than what we spend on cigarettes annually as a world, or that's what we spend on bottled water combined with, I think, the weight loss industry. Art can help us envision a plausible future.
It's almost as though Michelangelo had a book that said, here's what you can do to hasten the second coming in addition to this church.
I just think for me, I can't just leave us with what we're losing in the environment without saying we've got it. We can turn this around. It will be very proactive. And I'll strip it bare at the end and make it more poetic and find the art. But right now I'm still in this kind of thick end of the research and analysis, which is what I go through in all my projects. It's just this one will take X number of years, like 10, 15. Same with Confluence. I started that one in 2000. It's a project that threads through the entire Pacific Northwest. It's six sites, ostensibly started at the 200th anniversary of Lewis and Clark, but really it intertwines the history of Native Americans with an ecological history, with sort of Lewis and Clark's writings, which give us a point in time, exactly 200 years ago, what a place was like. Mm. So I'm very in love with learning about our history and getting to present that. And I think I am an optimist, and I'm a bit of a teacher, that we can learn from our – if we remember it accurately, we can repair, we can return, we can remember, and then sort of maybe change our future.
Maya Lin, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Maya Lin is an artist and architect. What is Missing is her multimedia memorial to the earth that you can learn more about at whatismissing.net.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by scientists that has been used by 70 million people worldwide, with training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
100 years ago, World War I was at its midpoint, but the pressures of the Great War were already beginning to fracture the old order of the 19th century and assemble the forces that would define the 20th. Although it was not apparent at the time, 1916 signaled the end of the Russian monarchy. After 1916, Tsarist Russia lost its ability to manage events within its own borders. 1916 would cast a shadow over the Romanov family that would become a bitter end 2 years hence with the Russian Revolution and the rise of Lenin. Historian Margaret Macmillan is the author of The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. She says that if you extend that road to 1916, you begin to see how Russia's turmoil would end up helping to define the 20th century.
I think one of the sad things about what happened to Russia in the 20th century is that if without the First World War, Russia might have gone on evolving, it wouldn't have been easy. There would have been political crises. There already had been before 1914, before the war started. But you could imagine, I think, that Russia could have evolved into some sort of constitutional monarchy and would have gradually built the civic institutions that are necessary if you're going to make a constitutional sort of and democratic sort of government work. But what the First World War did is destroy the old regime before there were really strong forces to take its place. And in 1917, a very shaky provisional government was formed. It wasn't able to cope with the many problems facing Russia. And the Bolsheviks, who were a tiny splinter party, most people hadn't even heard of them, particularly outside Russia, seized power in what really was a coup d'etat. But they managed to hang on to it. They hung on to it, of course, until 1989.
Does it surprise you the ideological influence that Bolshevism had in the 20th century, even though the regime in Russia was held together, particularly in the early going, with sticks and twigs?
Well, the regime in Russia in the early days was also held together with sheer brutality and really a ruthless use of terror. I mean, people were browbeaten into submission. If they didn't want to support the regime, they were hung up or they were executed. So it was a regime based on a certain amount of support, but it was also based on using all the weapons at its disposal. The thing about Bolshevism, I think, is that it took a while for its true outlines to emerge. And I think a lot of people outside Russia really saw it as some sort of hopeful sign. I mean, the world was very badly shaken. In some cases, regimes disappeared, societies were turned upside down by the First World War. And so a lot of people thought there must be something better. And they thought perhaps there really is something better in Russia. And in a funny way, the less you knew about what the Bolsheviks were like, the more you could put your faith in them. And that's what a lot of people around the world did.
Would you say that 100 years after 1916, the fact that we know a lot about Russia puts it in a fundamentally different stance in regards to the rest of the world, that this is the first time Russia has really had to, or at least this generation is the first time Russia has really had to accept the identity as it really is and not rely so much on myths?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think we now know a lot more about Russia. There's been a lot more reporting. There's much more open access, although it's still a regime in Russia which tries to control the news and tries to control access to information. But I think you still see inside Russia stories that the Russians tell themselves about how they're different. I mean, every nation does. And I think a common theme, and you saw it in the 19th century, early in the 20th century, and we're seeing it again, is that Russia somehow is different from Europe, different from the West, that it has more soul, that it's a more spiritual sort of society. Whether or not that's true, of course, is beside the point. But it's a very powerful myth. And it's one, I think, that the Russians often tell themselves and have done through the centuries.
When we spoke in the lead up to the 100th year anniversary of the Great War and what happened in Sarajevo, There was a lot of talk about similarities between anticipating radical change then and feeling radical change that we're on the edge of something now. Those were easy comparisons to make because we don't know what's going to happen, and our sense of anticipation can be compared to what went on 100 years ago. But if you look 100 years from 2016 to 1916, it's almost impossible to compare the sense of demoralization that there must have been in Europe and Russia and all of these nations in the middle of this war. Can you take us back to the sense of never-ending gloom that 1916 must have been all about?
Well, I think in 1916, of course, they'd clearly realized, because they had 2 years of war by now, almost 2 years of war, that it wasn't going to be a war that was going to end with an easy and quick victory. And so they knew they were in for a long haul. But I do think it wasn't total gloom. I mean, there were people on both sides, and this is one of the reasons the war kept going, people on both sides who thought just one more push and we'll win, or we still have a hope of winning. And so I think there was a sense that the war had to be fought. And I think people on both sides in the war also felt, although they clearly most of them disliked the war, that they were fighting for something important. They were fighting for their own civilization. They were fighting for their own families. They were fighting for their own homes. And so there was support for the war. I mean, I think in one of the curious things, really, which I think historians haven't explored enough, is how long European countries put up with the demands of the First World War and how long their publics put up with it. I mean, you think of what the war did to societies and the terrible losses and millions of soldiers being lost and the ways in which societies have been drained of their resources. And what really strikes me is how the countries held together. I mean, Russia, which was the shakiest of the great powers, stayed in the war until 1917. And so I think it's really a question worth exploring. What was it that kept Europeans in the war? And what was it that kept them thinking that they simply had to stick it out?
And the notion of a few boots on the ground in Syria turns everyone, to stone in the West today. It seems like none of the numbers from World War I are even remotely tolerable in our time.
No, I mean, in World War I, it's estimated, and we'll never know for sure what the exact count was, that 9 million men died. I mean, that's the size of a large city. It's a huge number. I mean, you're right. I mean, we now react to a single death of a soldier with horror. And in a way, perhaps we're nicer. Perhaps we care more about individual lives. What strikes me as extraordinary about the world 100 years ago was that people accepted, with sorrow, of course, but they accepted those losses because they thought it was in a useful cause.
Margaret McMillan is author of The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. She's professor of international history at Oxford. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
New Year's Day. My, that whole year just stretched out in front of us right now. Seems long. It will go fast, but not as fast as last year. 2016, you see, is a leap year and a Summer Olympics year and a presidential election year. Those events should help pass the time. Any thoughts about the next 12 months?
My name is Sue, and I'm calling from Sterling, Virginia. I am looking forward to good health and happiness for my loved ones, their loved ones, and me, and a heart transplant for my husband. What I'm dreading is a heart transplant for my husband. Happy holidays to everyone.
This is Corey calling from Cleveland, Ohio, and I am looking forward to getting rid of the 15 pounds of emotions I've eaten this year. I'm not looking forward to the work it's going to take to get rid of those pounds.
Hi, this is Holly in Portland, Oregon. I'm getting a new knee. My second knee is going to be replaced, so I'm looking forward to better mobility and hiking and biking with my children. I'm really dreading the 2016 election coverage because the vitriol in lieu of substantive debate is disheartening and I believe very dangerous. We need to hold our politicians to high standards as they represent the people in all of our diverse ideas. Happy holidays, everyone.
There's the personal and there's the political.
Hey, this is Steve from the Bronx. I'm looking forward to the inevitable decline of Donald Trump and Ben Carson, but I'm not looking forward to the rise of Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio as reasonable alternatives.
This is Barry Wynn calling from Brighton, Michigan. For 2016, I'm looking forward to the end of this election cycle, and I'm dreading everything that leads up to the end of this election cycle.
Rob from Florida. I'm most looking forward to Bernie Sanders winning the presidency in 2016, conversely. I dread what our future will be if he doesn't.
All right. Well, forget your dread for just a moment and think about our pal Laura on Pins and Needles right now.
My name is Laura Cole. I'm calling from Salem, Oregon. And the thing I'm most looking forward to in 2016 is getting married on January 2nd to my darling love. And the most thing I'm dreading is just saying goodbye to all my friends and family when they leave and go back home. It's going to be wonderful to see them. So, yay. Happy New Year, everyone.
This is Sean from San Antonio. I'm really looking forward to potentially going to med school next year and regretting a possible Donald Trump nomination by the GOP.
Hi, this is Laura calling from Hamden, Connecticut. What I am both most looking forward to and also most dreading in 2016 is we will begin searching for colleges for my now junior in high school son. And it's very exciting, but also it's going to be a tough time because he is the youngest and the last to leave the nest. But we are also looking forward to him becoming more independent and us having eventually some more time at home with just the two of us.
This is Tyler from Malden, Massachusetts. And the thing I am dreading and looking most forward to in 2016 happens to be the same thing. My Air Force unit and I are deploying in the summer and dreading for obvious reasons. And I'm excited for what I'll learn and what I'll take from it while I'm there.
Best of luck, Tyler. Come home safe now. Jersey City, New Jersey, I am most looking forward to working less and least looking forward to being another year older. Well, we can all relate to that. Trevor in San Bruno, California, quitting smoking and quitting smoking. And finally, Rebecca in Belmont, California, looking forward to moving to a new home, which my fiance and I just bought, and my wedding. First time married, I'll be 57. Dreading? Nothing other than I have too much to do. Gratitude for all the wonderful things. We'll keep that thought of beautiful 57-year-old bride Rebecca and have a happy new year, everyone. If you want to tell us about it, call us at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
'15 was a good year for rockets and the rocket men who want to turn their personal billions into space travel dreams for the millions. It almost wasn't a great year for Elon Musk's SpaceX company, which had suffered some serious setbacks in 2015, until nearly Christmas Eve when the Falcon 9 launched, put a payload in orbit, and then returned to Earth, thus proving out the SpaceX claim of a commercial, reusable launch vehicle. Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic, Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin also put their money and engineering bets on the line with high-profile launches last year, and more to come in 2016. Joining us is Bill Ostrov, who's aerospace and defense analyst for Forecast International. Bill, this was a banner year for commercial rocketry, yes?
Yeah, it really was.
And would you say there's somebody who's ahead at this point? I mean, you have Elon Musk really coming in at the end there with a terrific launch that reversed the setbacks that they had earlier in the year. Is it fair to say that Musk has proven what he said he would do?
Yeah, it looked like it was going to be a pretty bad year for SpaceX. Back in June, they actually had a launch failure, and it looked like they might be having some problems. But they really turned it around with that launch last week and the successful landing. I think that SpaceX probably is in the lead right now, and they benefit from having a backlog of contracts from both the U.S. government and from commercial companies.
You know, I've read some of your work and other folks in the aerospace industry. I get the impression that the government sort of space program, the defense industry, all of that kind of government world wants Elon Musk to win here.
Yeah, it certainly seems like Elon Musk has it in good with the Pentagon and with NASA. You know, he's doing some creative things and getting the costs of launching rockets down. And I think that's where a lot of that comes from. And I'm sure his personality helps as well.
Yeah, right. He's a good brand.
yeah, he definitely is.
Can you describe for us the differences between the three efforts? Because there are some differences.
So SpaceX is working with both government and commercial, and that's one of the primary differences between them and some of the others like Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin.
But Musk's SpaceX is a solid fuel rocket, right?
Yes.
And it's reusable. It's basically a rocket like you've seen before. It just happens to be reusable.
When it first began launching a few years ago, it actually was being used as an expendable launch vehicle. He's working to slowly and incrementally increase the capabilities of that rocket, including adding the ability to land and be reused.
Now, is that the same as Blue Origin, the Jeff Bezos entry in this race?
So Blue Origin is designing their spacecraft to be reusable right from the start. And their focus is more on taking passengers into orbit. And they could take payloads also, but their primary focus is passengers. Whereas SpaceX is working on taking payloads and passengers as well. Sort of a evenly split for SpaceX.
And the Virgin Galactic entry is more like an aeronautic, an airplane rocket hybrid.
Yes, their spacecraft is probably the most different from the other two. It actually is carried into the air with a carrier aircraft and then launched. I think it's from 35,000 feet in the air. The rocket is launched and then travels the rest of the way into space. And then it would land like a regular airplane on a runway.
And for all three of these companies, is there enough business out there right now for them to actually get revenue while they develop what they claim is their goal, and that is a commercial space capability that will allow space tourism?
Well, I think that's actually where SpaceX's advantage comes in. They've actually been able to do that, and they have contracts with NASA to bring supplies to the space station. They're working on developing contracts with the Air Force to carry military satellites, and they already have contracts with commercial companies to launch commercial communications and remote sensing satellites. The launch just last week, they were actually carrying satellites for a commercial company called Orbcomm. So they have been able to generate revenue much better than the others. And I think that's partly because of their more incremental approach, where they introduced the rocket as an expendable launch vehicle first and then added more capabilities later on.
So then who's Branson going to sell to at this point?
Branson is going more towards the space tourism market, where SpaceX would carry NASA astronauts. Richard Branson is going more for wealthy individuals that are looking for an exotic vacation.
And is that the same with the Jeff Bezos Blue Origin, or does he have something beyond the tourism idea, the quick sort of out of orbit and then back to Earth kind of program?
He seems to be going towards the same market as Richard Branson.
And does NASA estimate how big this market might be, and what is the viability of the ticket price at this point?
It's still very early to have any accurate estimates of the size. I think that in order for it to really take off, I think that the price will need to go down so that you can appeal to a much wider customer base.
We're talking about, you know, $30,000, $50,000 or more?
It's hard to say for sure. Right now, they're in the six-figure range. I think Virgin Galactic is $250,000 for a seat. Blue Origin hasn't published prices yet. I think you'd probably have to be somewhere in the five-figure range. Yeah, probably around $30,000 to $50,000 in order for that market to be more sustainable.
That's still a heck of a lot of money for a selfie.
It is a ton of money. We'll have to see how that market develops going forward.
Do Branson and Bezos have an interest in developing some sort of space tourism hotel capability in Earth orbit?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. There's actually another company that we haven't mentioned yet called Bigelow Aerospace. They are actually developing an inflatable structure that would be able to open up in space. And you can actually send either space tourists to go on vacation or have scientists or astronauts doing work there.
And so that would really complete the puzzle of this tourism idea, where you could actually drop people off at a location as opposed to just sort of take them up and bring them back to Earth. But again, all of this is way past 2016, but we certainly saw a lot of proven out capabilities on all three of these rocket ventures in 2015. Bill, thanks so much.
Sure, no problem. Anytime.
Bill Ostrov is an aerospace and defense analyst at Forecast International, and you can stay tuned to The Takeaway in 2016. We might not be joining the space race, but we are looking for America's greatest innovation, and you could be a part of all of that. And here's something to take with you today. If you're feeling ambitious and maybe a little too queasy for rockets and are somewhere near Buffalo, New York today, you might want to check out the racing event of the season. Ransomville Speedway is once again hosting its annual New Year's Day amateur car race, street cars only, in 4, 6, and 8-cylinder classes. No all-wheel drive, no trucks. Minivans are okay. Hybrids, no way. This race is all about enlarging your carbon footprint. It's called the Hangover 150. Last year's 8-cylinder winner Tim Phillips of Grand Island, New York said, "The Hangover always seems to give me my racing kicks. The Hangover is no-pressure racing. I really like that." Good luck today, Tim. And that's all from us. Happy New Year, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Public Radio International.